Hello, everybody. Cal Banyan, Cal Banyan's Hypnosis, etc. If you're watching this podcast or this video anywhere except calbanyan.com, you want to go there now because right below this video, you know what? There's extra text. There's video, text and links and graphics that could make this video more important to you. Hey, guess what? This is my last one in this series with Meredith Locker, one of my favorite one of my favorite co-hosts, along with L. Ron Ferguson. And I'm just so tickled to have her with us for this last in this series of four. She'll be back. But let me tell you about Meredith. Meredith is a top one percenter in the profession. She really knows what she's doing. She really cares about the profession. She cares about doing good work. She cares about her clients, and her clients rave about her. If I had someone in the Los Angeles area that needed some hypnotherapy, I'd refer them to her. How you doing, Meredith?
I'm doing so good, Cal. I'm so excited to answer some questions from viewers today. That'll be fun. Thank you so much. And I want to make sure people know who you are. You are Cal Banyan. You are the creator of Five Path, the person who brought us Seventh Path Self-Hypnosis. You are the reason why we do these podcasts and so generously share this free, exciting hypnosis information week in and week out. I know people get mad at you about it, but I think the most people appreciate it, that's for sure. I know I do. And, I'm happy to call you my mentor. Thank you so much for all you do.
I'm so happy to be here. And, The hate mail, it seems to be going down. I think they've finally given up and said, what the heck, Cal is giving out more in his podcasts than you'll get in most hypnosis training seminars. So they've just kind of given up. But we've gotten fan mail through Facebook and all that good stuff. And we're really appreciated in faraway lands, the land down under, the land up over there, and all those different places around the world. I only wish that I could have someone volunteer to go through all these podcasts and put little subtitles down here so that it would be in Mandarin and Spanish and French and German and Russian and, did I say Chinese and Japanese? All those. That would be so wonderful just to bring all this stuff to the whole wide world. That's it. That's all I wanted to say. All right, that's it for today. Podcast over.
Done.
That was easy. You got anything for me?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So we have been talking more about the time tunneling technique, and I realized as we were wrapping up the last podcast that I had one other little tidbit, important tidbit, that I thought it would be worth mentioning to further help people be successful as they start to integrate the time tunneling technique into their practice. Now, we have covered the time tunneling technique now in last episode, so if you haven't yet watched that one, please go to it first. And we also got in detail over the course of three episodes, podcast 211, 212, and 213. So I would recommend reviewing those first before watching this episode. Now, we got deep into using time tunneling technique for age progression last podcast. And, we kind of talked about the fluidity of going through regression using the time tunneling technique and then how you use it to go into the future to double check your work and to also allow people to experience successfully that which they are trying to accomplish. But it occurred to me we didn't mention the symptom producing event, the SPE, as being a course of this modality. And so I thought it would be worth you mentioning how you would integrate the symptom producing event using time tunneling technique when working with people like smokers or overeaters or pretty much any behavioral issue where there was a time when the actual behavior started. So do you want to talk a little bit about that, Cal?
Well, I'm really wondering if everybody out there knows what a symptom-producing event is. So I'm going to just kind of give a rundown on that. Now, sometimes the problem manifests with the ISC, the initial sensitizing event. For example, you go back at 3 years old, they get this idea that the world is unsafe. And so there's this fear inside of them. And they've come to you as an adult for this feeling of anxiety and fear. And gosh, it's been there all the time, or since the ISC. But sometimes the thing that they've come in to see you about manifests in the individual's life sometime after the cause of the problem. For example, let's say the individual has come for eating too much problem. They're eating too much, and you know, it's become unhealthy and they're overweight. And as we go back in time tunneling back, or affect bridge back, we uncover the ISC. And the ISC was when they're 3 or 4 years old. But they don't really start overeating until they're 12 or 13 years old. So there's some event at that 12 or 13 year old age that where they learn to manage the like anxiety that was created when they were 3 by eating. You hear us talk about feel bad, distract. So the feeling bad could have occurred when they were 3, but they really didn't find a way to manage it through distraction until later on in life. Maybe they have anxiety since 3, but they don't start smoking until they're 15 to handle the anxiety, or eating until they're 12 to handle the anxiety, or drinking too much alcohol to self-medicate the anxiety until they're 18, 19, 20 years old. So that event that where they, be it the ISC or some subsequent sensitizing event, where they manifest the symptom or the behavior that they're coming in to see you about, that is the symptom-producing event. Okay, so how do we handle that with the time tunneling technique? I unless I'm missing something, Meredith, I don't see how it would be any different. As we are time tunneling back, we will uncover the SSEs, and then we will get to the ISC. Now, the SSE, where they start doing the behavior or having the emotion they came in to see you about, that's the SS, that is also the symptom-producing event. So what am I missing there, Meredith?
You're not, but I think when we introduce new techniques that oftentimes people will have trouble integrating pieces from the old into the new. And so it's just really important, I thought, for us to recognize the SPE in this discussion and help people to see that it isn't different, that you would just do a date time progression to the SPE, even if you didn't visit it on the way back through the SSEs to the ISE, you would still get to it and do some intervention on it after resolving the ISE through informed child technique. People are learning this brand new, and it might get left out of the scenario if we don't mention it. So that's what it's all about.
Well, that's what one of the things I like about having you and Elron co-hosting me, because you'll pick up on those little things that I might just kind of, you know, blur over. Good. All right, what else you got for me?
Beautiful. So we have some fantastic questions that have been sent in by viewers. Thank you so much. And one of them is regarding forgiveness of others, which in 5-Path is phase 3. In case you haven't watched it yet, we do a 5-part podcast series on getting deep into forgiveness of others. They are podcasts 195 through 199. So if you aren't already really familiar with forgiveness of others, I would advocate that you watch those first before listening to this. Otherwise, you might get confused. But we have a fantastic question from Jane, and I know one that a lot of 5-Pathers wonder about. So I'm going to bring this to you, Cal, and have you give us your dollars. I don't call them cents anymore. The cents aren't valuable enough, but give us your dollars, your $2.
These are my golden nuggets.
Your golden nuggets of information about this issue. Jane says that she often feels that the part in forgiveness of others, where we ask the client to put all that discomfort, all that emotion into their arm and down into the fist, and then to express, release the anger into the pillow, doesn't always feel like the right approach. It can seem too dramatic with some clients and makes me feel a little foolish when that mode of expression just doesn't seem to fit. I'd love to know if this has come up for anyone else.
I'm sure it comes up with for people, and probably in my earlier days I might have had the same kind of concern, but to me this falls into the same problem of, you know, judging our clients with regard to where, for example, the problem began before you do age regression. You think, oh, the client said it started when they're about 10 years old, so that's where I'm going to go. That is totally wrong. That is, you know, taking the client at face value, and I wouldn't ever do that, because over and over and over again, it is shown that the ISC happens before when the client is aware of the problem beginning. So, by the way, we were just talking about symptom-producing events. What clients typically tell you where the problem began is not the ISC, but the symptom-producing event. Okay, now with forgiveness, if you say, oh, this person is just not going to be dramatic enough, or they're too frail, or, you know, they're too angelic, or, I don't know, proper to beat on the pillow to put, to neutralize some of this emotions inside. Now, let me just, I think that you are making the same mistake that you make if you take the person's word at when the problem began. You're trying to judge a book by its cover. So, I got a couple things I want to talk about all at once. One is, when we do the forgiveness of others work, one of the things we're going to do is we'll have somebody express the emotion that's inside, and the emotion is anger at this other person who they believe has hurt them or was part of the cause of the problem, and have them beat some of that emotion, if not all of it they're carrying at the moment, out of themselves. Okay, one of the things that's really important is you understand that is not in and of itself going to cause any long-term change. We do not have them do that in order to accept the suggestions we're going to give them. We don't have them do that to expecting any kind of long-term change. It is something that five pathers do so that the resistance to having the next part of the forgiveness process occur is minimal. And that is having insight. You see, five path, because it's so powerful, because it is an insight process. It's not just pure direct suggestion. Phase one's preparation, testing, and convincing. Phase two is age regression, which is an insight process where they can apply new insights, the adult's insight, with the input of the hypnotherapist, to these firmly held beliefs that are held inside of them that came from the past. In forgiveness of self and forgiveness of others, I've said this many times in other podcasts, I say it in class, anger is a wall. And when you are angry with someone, you put up this wall, and you don't care about their point of view. You don't care about what their motivation was. You are in this protective zone, you're angry at them, they've hurt you, and you're not going to be insightful. When we have people beat at on the pillow and say, you hurt me, you made me feel, you hurt me when, because of you I never got to do this, or because of you I had to do this other thing that I didn't like, and we express that anger, what we're really doing is we're beating down the wall. We're expressing that emotion which causes resistance to insight. And I believe that you cannot judge by looking at someone as to whether or not they need to do that. And I would give everybody, child, priest, monk, husband, wife, philosopher, physician, ballet dancer, from the most frail to the strongest, bodybuilder, professional football player, everybody the chance to beat down that wall. Because, and and this is even more true when dealing with psychosomatic stuff that's held in the body, psychosomatic pain or psychogenic illness. We need to kind of shake things up and have them powerfully express that anger until in that moment there is nothing left to express. Right, they're starting off, they're saying, well, there's a point where you go, put an ending on this, you're such a, and they start off with, you're such a this bad word, and you're such a that bad word, until finally they're no longer beating it with ferocity, they're just kind of going, you know, very, very little anger left. And at that point, we can move into the next part, which is the 10 keys to forgiveness work, and provide them with the insight that is going to give them long-term change. There's different people that use other kind of anger expression type things, and I just never have to do that. When I'm having them hit the pillow, if there's resistance to hitting the pillow, I just reframe it. Look, we're not hitting the person. What we're doing is we're pumping the anger out of you. We need to pump out the anger so that we can proceed forward. And so I will tell them, think about like an old pump handle on an old well that goes into water. The old-fashioned wells where they pump the water out of the ground, like from an old Western or something like that. And we got to pump this emotion out of you. Let's do it. And so then I'll have their hand going up and down, and of course it would be landing on the pillow. I say, pump it out, instead of hit the pillow, as the slight change. And it gives them the opportunity to really say what needs to be said, express it in any way that needs to be expressed. And then when there's like nothing else that can be expressed in that moment, boom, then we go right into the 10 keys for forgiveness, so that they can have the insights, and the insights then provide the long-lasting, permanent change, because they can't think about those people and those situations in the same way. And when you stop thinking about them in the old way, you stop feeling about them in the old way, and you stop behaving in the way that you've been behaving, which was a way of coping with the emotion inside you you didn't like. So I always do it, everybody. But there's certainly other people that have other type of approaches. And if you do it and you're having trouble getting the insight, then that says, man, maybe you got to go back to hitting the pillow. But if you are getting the insights, then what you're doing is adequate. You know, no matter what it is, the proof is in the pudding, as they say. So you got to remember that the hitting the pillow is not therapy. It has no long-lasting results. It's just something we do to create an environment in the mind where we can now begin to give the person insight. So if you can do that by, I don't know, rubbing their fingers together or something like that, if you can get rid of enough of that emotion so that you can then move into the insight process, then I suppose that's good enough. I just don't do that. I'm sure you do have some softer approach you want to talk about.
Yeah, you know, I work with so many athletes, Cal, and oftentimes because it's not great to do five path with an athlete when they're in the middle of their season, you know, unfortunately, I get to do the work with them sometimes because they're injured. And so whether it's because they have a leg injury and kind of pumping into the pillow makes them nervous, or they actually have an arm problem problem or a wrist problem or a shoulder problem or that kind of thing, I have had to get creative and come up with other ways to do it. Now, if, you know, normally I have them kind of start with their right arm and tell them you can use both arms if you like. If somebody's injured on their right, I might advocate for them to do it on their left. So that's always an option. But some people who are injured are just kind of extra nervous to shake things up, especially an athlete where their body and their healing is so important. So I have used a technique where I have them, you know, visualize breathing it out and literally aggressively breathing and pulling the emotion into their throat and then seeing it being pushed out and transmuted in the atmosphere. So I have used that as an alternative with some clients. But yes, I mean, being able to pump for those clients who are anti-violence is key. It's key to understanding that you can have them pump it out. I mean, who can't do this? It's not that hard, and it won't go against someone's stance against violence. But when there are injuries, or if someone is just point blank refusing to pump into the pillow, then maybe a blowing out technique like I use, or some other technique that you can come up with, will help you.
Okay, now I'm a little bit confused about something.
Yeah.
Okay, so you say, maybe it just all ran together in my mind. Now, typically we don't do five path with athletes that are competing, right?
Yes.
Because it can kind of just scramble their eggs and have trouble concentrating for the period of time or for a few days while they're in the five path process. But so then we wouldn't be doing phase three and phase four, and so that wouldn't be an issue. Right.
What I'm saying, Cal, is that often when I have the opportunity to do five path and do all of the phases with an athlete is when they're benched, so they're not competing. So that's why sometimes athletes take the opportunity to do this therapeutic work when they're injured. And I'm saying that because I have them injured, that it can be more problematic to do the pumping or the pounding of the pillow. So you're right. They are not doing five path when competing, but when injured, they're not competing. And so that's when I often get a chance to do five path with my athletes.
Okay, I gotcha. So what kind of injury? So we obviously have like shoulder injuries, arm injuries, back injuries, neck injuries, where it wouldn't be good to pound on the pillow, right?
Yeah, and I've even had some because, you know, the pillow is on their lap. And so if they have a knee injury or a hip injury or an upper thigh injury, they will sometimes, you know, cringe at the idea of hitting something that's on their lap that's in the region of their other lower body injuries.
Have them hit the arm of the chair. You have a big, wonderful recliner that's got thick arms, right?
Yes, yes.
That's a possibility.
Yeah, it is a possibility. And certainly making it very clear that they are pumping and not necessarily pounding, unless they feel comfortable to do so. But, you know, a lot of times when someone's injured anywhere in their body, they're hesitant to move aggressively in any particular way. And so I try to work with that as best I can and help to keep them therapeutically viable, but also safe.
Ooh, I like that. Therapeutically viable. That's really good.
Yes, good.
I'm going to write that down. Therapeutically viable. Okay. And it would probably also be therapeutically valuable, too.
Indeed.
That's cool. All right. How are we doing on time?
Okay. Well, we're just about time to wrap it up, but I think we're going to get to one more question before we do.
Squeeze it in.
I appreciate this question. So thank you, Jane, for that question. Hope that answered it adequately. And so we have another question from somebody named Carl, who wants to know. He says that he's read about hypnosis being contraindicated for heart disease. He's read that it's not a good idea to do hypnosis with somebody that has heart disease, but he has had a hard time finding more information about that and wanted our opinion about it.
Okay. So he's not saying it's contraindicated to do hypnosis for helping someone with heart disease. He's saying you shouldn't do hypnosis of any kind with someone who has heart disease, right?
It's unclear exactly his specifics of it. He just says, I have read that heart diseases would make hypnosis contraindicated.
Okay. Here's the deal. If you know that this person is hanging on by a thread, you know, and he could go any moment, or she, you know, they got that nitroglycerin tablet, you know, ready to go. You know, you probably don't want to work with them because the last thing you want to do is have at the 10 o'clock news, you know, hypnotist kills client. So, you know, I wouldn't recommend that. But when there's hypnosis. I mean, there's lots and lots of people going around with heart disease and hypertension and stuff like that, that I would ask them. I would say, well, first I would think, what kind of hypnotist am I? Am I a scriptnotist where I'm mainly just going to do progressive relaxation and then read a very relaxing script with visualization? And, you know, of course, the doctor is the ultimate expert on this, but, you know, there's no reason why you wouldn't be able to do that. You're just relaxing them. I've never heard of anyone, you know, dying from relaxation. You know, if you know, if you're a doctor out there and you know of a certain circumstance where you should never allow someone with heart disease to relax too much, you please leave a comment below. You know, I'm not a medical professional. But I have hypnotized a whole bunch of people, and I've taught a whole bunch of people to hypnotize people, and I've supervised a lot of people to hypnotize people, and this is just not an issue. Now, if you're a five-pather and you're going to do stuff like have hit on the pillow and say, I hate what you did to me, express all that anger, and you got down there that they're, you know, got nitroglycerin tablets and they have heart disease, I would ask the client, you know, does your doctor giving you any restrictions against like exercise or getting upset or like, is it okay with your doctor if you have sex, you know? And if they say, no, I don't have any restrictions like that, then they should be fine for hypnosis and even, you know, five path. But it's always good to err on the side of caution. And, you know, you could have that, get a note from the doctor that it's okay. But I think that should be all there is to it. Anything you want to add?
We did do another podcast, number 186, on using 5-PATH and doing hypnosis with chronic illnesses. So there may be a little bit more information that we got into about this there. But yeah, specifically, I've worked with all kinds of people. You know, sometimes they aren't coming in because of their heart disease. They're coming in to deal with something else, and it just so happens that they are on medication and that they are consulting with a doctor for that issue, and never have had one single issue with it. And certainly, you know, whenever you release stress, which our process does, it benefits the overall health of the body. So, you know, I do it, but yes, safety is the best way. So be safe about it.
You're awesome, Meredith.
Thank you. So are you, Cal.
Hey. All right. Gonna wrap it up?
Yes. Please do send us your questions and comments. We definitely want to hear from you. We do really care about creating hypnosis community. It's important to both Cal and myself, as well as Elron. And so do send us what you want to know. If we weren't clear on something, please take the initiative to ask for clarity about that. We're happy to do so. We do these podcasts to bring clarity. So help us to do that for you. You can send them directly to me at meredith@yourpathhypnosis.com. You can post them right down there at calbanion.com. I do go there in preparation for our podcast filming. And I look forward to hearing from you in the future. My name is Meredith Locker, and I'm signing off.
And this is Cal Banyan. And you know what? I wish you so much success with hypnosis. Get out there. Help somebody. If you don't think you have adequate training, sign up for one of my classes. Do what you got to do, because you can make a difference in your own life and in a whole bunch of other people's lives. That's it. Cal Banyan. This recording is the property of Cal Banyan and Cal Banyan's Banyan Publishing Incorporated. All rights reserved, for private use only, may not be duplicated without written permission.